Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for November the 4th, 2019. Now, this is David Corey along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thank you for joining us this evening. We have two major segments in our show tonight. First, we have a series of interviews made by the VA about the experiences of military veterans in dealing with post-traumatic stress and related problems. We also have an interview about the VA's excellent coaching into care program that we mention every week, that we plug every week on the show. And then in our second segment tonight, we have news and information on various topics of interest. So please stay tuned. But first, let's go over to Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard.
Hey, David, and good evening, everyone. Hope everybody's doing well tonight. Yeah, before we get into these recordings, I just want to share some developments today in the practice, our law practice, dealing with the VA and helping our veterans. The situation, and veterans, really listen closely to this because it's very important. Today, I was able to provide the medical evidence needed in a PTSD and an unemployability claim case. And I submitted it to the decision review officer, we call him a DRO, at the VA in St. Pete. And he agreed that the veteran should be increased from 10% to 70% for his PTSD, and then that triggered the unemployability compensation. So the veteran was going to go from 10% to 100%, which is a terrific result for the veteran. And normally I would be thrilled as punch there and very excited for the veteran. Unfortunately, the decision review officer then turned and said, well, the effective date is going to be the day of the doctor's disability benefit questionnaire for PTSD, which is November 3rd, yesterday. And I said, no, it's the effective date. The effective date should be the date that he filed the claim for the increase, which would have gone back to 2017. So he would have gone from, he's going to go from 10% to 100%. So you can do the math on what his retro payment would have been. It would have been about 30 months times approximately $3,000 per month, which is about a $90,000 retro payment for the veteran. So the decision review officer gave me all this mumbo-jumbo why he's not going to go back to the 2017 date. So, you know, David and I talked about it earlier today, and we've seen other decision review officers do that. However, this decision review officer routinely and consistently over the last 2 years in dealing with me always went back to the filing of the claim date, especially when the decision, the initial PTSD decision was coming out of the Gainesville VA mental comp and Penn exam department there, which he has routinely told me he basically discounts that particular office because they have a history of not stepping up and rating our veterans properly and instead giving them either no rating or a very minimal rating. So you can understand my frustration today and the frustration of the veteran. He was looking forward to the retro payment. The veteran's 72 years old. So the bottom line is the decision review officer is sticking to his guns. I'm kind of convinced that somebody, his coach or who's ever above him, finally has told him he's got to now be on the dark side, and this is the way it's going to be. And, you know, the veteran through counsel can appeal the decision. They're going to issue a statement of the case, and we can appeal it, which I will do. But as you can imagine, we've got a veteran who's 72 years old. By the time it gets to the Board of Veteran Appeals, he's going to be at least 73, and then I know I'm going to win the case, and it'll be remanded back to the VA. So this veteran may be 75 years old before he finally gets his retro payment. So, David and I were talking today, and one of the things that we want to kind of make clear to all you veterans is that, you know, when you go in, whether you're being represented by a law firm or a DAV or a veteran service officer, you have to make sure that you file a statement of claim. And you've got to, in that statement of claim, you've got to specifically set forth all of the symptoms, and you can, you know, get the DBQ form and, set out all those symptoms that you've experienced, nightmares, dealing with crowds, and you've seen the forms. You know that if you've ever had a PTSD claim, you know what the symptoms are. So you want to make sure that you put that out there, and you make it clear that those symptoms that you're experiencing today were the same symptoms that you were experiencing even before you filed your initial claim. It's very important to document the record that way. I'm not saying it's going to change the VA's handling of it at their level, but I really believe that at the Board of Veteran Appeals level, it will have an impact, and it will result in a remand back to the VA. So just another frustrating day dealing with the VA and frustrating for the veteran because he was really looking forward to putting this case behind him. But David, before I move on to the recording, do you want to just chime in on that?
No, that's a great point and great insight the veterans ought to heed, because I think veterans and many veteran service organizations that provide representation to veterans, they get lulled into complacency. They think all they need to do is fill out the basic claims forms, and then they put their total blind trust in the VA, which is unwarranted. As we've seen in the last couple years with the changes in the appeals system, but overall in the approach the VA seems to be taking, is to put more of a burden on the veteran and the veteran's representative to build the case, to build the evidence, or else the VA is going to take a real minimal approach to things, either by denying service connection for disability, or if they grant service connection, typically that they issue a very low rating that underestimates the impact on the veteran of the disability. So, yeah, heed Rick's advice, and that's great advice. So, all right, well, let's we ready for our...
Yeah. So I want to remind you veterans tonight that this is a call-in show. Our phone number is 1-888-627-6008. Again, toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. If you have a topic you want to address or you want to comment on just what Dave and I were just talking about, please do, because we love your input and your viewpoint on the topic. Our first segment today, we're going to hear from some veterans as well as some VA employees. Post-traumatic stress is a common but often misunderstood condition that many veterans suffer from, particularly if they have been in combat. In today's show, thanks to the VA's online program called Make the Connection, available on YouTube and other social media platforms, we will hear from five veterans about their experiences dealing with the effects of their military service, as well as how they coped with making the transition from military to civilian life. In the first tape, we hear from an Army veteran named Dan, who served in Operation Desert Storm. He discusses his problems adjusting to civilian life and how he realized finally that he needed help to cope with his problems. Doug, please roll tape number one.
My name's Dan. I served in the Army, United States Army. I was 13 Bravo Field Artillery. I served from 1987 to 1991. My whole tour was, I was stationed in Germany, just outside of Frankfurt. I took it very serious, and I really removed the civilian side of myself. I noticed that I wasn't relating to my friends and family. The whole reason I got out was to save my marriage. We weren't fighting, it's not like we weren't getting along, but I really did start loving the Army and the military more than my wife, especially after Desert Storm. That was like the icing. That's what took the last little bit of civilian, you know, the civilian Dan away. It was, that person was gone. Coming back to the world, just the shock of everybody has a different haircut now. Everybody talks different. Everybody dresses different. Nobody talks like me. Nobody acts like me. Nobody thinks like me. I short-circuited. You know, the severe nightmares, the severe social anxiety, not being able to be around crowds, can go to stores, things like that. And over the years, that got worse and worse to the point where I wouldn't go anywhere without my wife, except maybe a couple, like a sporting goods store or something. When it was any place that had weapons, guns, I was comfortable. It was weird. So I became a recluse. I did drink, but I didn't do it all the time. You know, I would go out and drink, but what I would do is I would go out and go to a bar and try to find the biggest, nastiest person in there I possibly could, and I would do whatever I had to start a fight. And one night I was in an alley and I was fighting this guy, and a friend of mine came out to look for me, and he found me and he stopped it. I realized every time during one of these fights, somebody had to stop me. And what if somebody isn't there to stop me sometime? And I actually, what if I kill somebody? I realized I needed help, and I went to the VA. I told my wife, I said, I need help. And it was hard. It was incredibly hard to admit that I needed help. I started seeing a psychiatrist, and the first one didn't work. You have to find the right one. And I did finally find a good counselor there. And then also the vet center. I started getting involved with the vet center. The VA referred me there. So between the two, I was able to start integrating myself back into society. And if I hadn't gone to the VA, I would not be sitting in this chair. When I was diagnosed with PTSD, I did get some relief, because now I have something to look at. I've been told why I act the way I act. Every Marine, soldier, airman, you give them a mission, they're going to succeed. And my mission was to live with PTSD. What I could relay to another veteran is, you know, we were there for each other on the field. And now we're here for each other in the world. We are the only ones that understand each other. If you have an issue, if you're at the end of that road and it doesn't look like there's any way out, go to the VA, because they have people there that understand, and they have people there that care, and they will do anything and everything they can to help you. We've sacrificed so much, sacrificing your life or your quality of life is not unacceptable. Don't give up on yourself. Go get the help you need.
I think that's great advice from Dan. And just in the interest of time, Rick, why don't we go on to our second tape tonight. We're going to hear next from an Army veteran named Darren, who discusses the problems he faced in transitioning from military active duty to civilian life. Doug, if you roll the second tape, please.
When I got out and retired, it's a lot of apprehension, because you're leaving a life that is so structured, it's so routine, and you know what kind of policies you have to follow, what kind of uniforms you have to wear, and a whole different speak. And so when you get out after 20 years of doing that and you get into the society where, you know, they may not have the work ethic or the work values that you are accustomed to, it can be very frustrating. As well as being an armor officer, there's not many tanks out in the real world. So I was like, well, what the heck am I going to do? My skills are with, you know, armor tanks and that type of thing. So I wasn't really sure what I was going to do, especially moving back to Minnesota. And in the area that we live right now, it has very small military bases and anything like that. So it's not like I could really go to work at a fort something and, you know, go to work as a contractor. So I had a lot of apprehensions when I got out of what I was going to do, where I would fit in, what kind of job I would get. And what I found out is that the skills that you bring out of the military, you know, the leadership skills, that the organizational skills, the commitment, the work ethic, and all of that is highly valuable in civilian life. But you have to also realize that civilian life is not military life. And so when you come in there and try to just go gangbusters on something, it doesn't always fly. So that was kind of hard getting used to at first. But as long as you can incorporate that, you know, you'll be all right. I mean, I remember some days where, you know, my guys would be working 24, 36, 48 hours straight when we were out in the fields. And, you know, if a tank went down, they worked till they fixed it. If it was 30 below zero, they were out there working and doing it. If it was 120 degrees, I was stationed in Fort Irwin, California for 3 years. You know, those guys were still out there working on the tanks, doing what they had to do to get the job done. And when you get into the civilian life, you know, you're kind of punching a clock in a lot of areas. Now, there are some jobs, of course, where you have that work ethic and the timelines and the suspenses, and that you have to get them done and no matter what. But for the majority of the civilian life, you know, you come in at 8, you leave at 4:30, and most of the people are leaving. And I find that probably a lot of the military people are sitting there by themselves in their office finishing whatever needed to be done that day. So I did find that there was kind of sometimes in some professions a work ethic that was punch the clock 9 to 5 and, you know, you were gone. So that kind of, you have to kind of ease into that. And to tell you the truth, the first couple years, I was a workaholic, and especially working in the Pentagon where you're working, you know, 12, 13 hours a day, 6, 7 days a week. To come back and only work 8 hours a day was different, to say the least. You know, when I was going home at 4:30, I'm like, geez, shouldn't I be working another 2 or 3 hours? So it takes some getting used to. So you can almost overextend yourself, I think, when you first get out and you have that commitment to the job that maybe not everybody else has.
Rick, what do you think?
Yeah, that was very good. The word you used for commitment to the job, I think, it's a different experience when you're committed in the service compared to, you know, maybe in civilian life. You know, a lot of people end up doing civilian jobs that they really don't like, but they need the money, so they've got to do the job no matter what. Whereas in the service, I think there's another motivation, not just the financial side of it, but there's just another motivation. And, you know, David, you can speak on that. You served, so I'm sure.
Yeah, well, it's true. And one aspect of military life, aside from the obvious one, which is you're serving at the call of your country, and you never know when a war might break out. You never know when a particular day might be a September 10th, you know, the day before a September 11th. You don't know when it might be the week before a country like Iraq invades Kuwait, leading to the Desert Shield and Desert Storm. You never know that, but you realize that you're basically, signed up for your period of obligation or enlistment, and you're basically at the call of the government. So it's a special kind of sacrifice that those in civilian jobs don't normally have, where they could, if they really don't like a job, they could quit and move on. Not the case in the military. A closed society unto itself with its own criminal code, very similar to a civilian criminal code, but it has some uniquely military offenses. Like in the military world, if you just quit your job, walked off the job, that's a crime called desertion, for which you go to prison. There's nothing like that in the civilian world. Or even if you're...
That doesn't happen at Walmart, huh?
No, and even if you're just late for work, being late for work in the military is a violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Now, they're not always going to court-martial you for it. You might get counseling or Article 15 non-judicial punishment, but the fact of the matter is it's a much stricter world, and it takes some adjustment to moving into that world and certainly moving out of that world back into the civilian world. So, Rick, why don't we go to our next tape? Who do we have?
Yeah, next we're going to hear from Marcus, who served from 2002 to 2006. Marcus was deployed three times and lost his buddies to a bomb on his last deployment. Right before coming home, because of his experiences, he was frequently on edge, angry, and began to engage in dangerous behavior. After a motorcycle accident made him stop and think, he reached out for the help he needed at the VA. Doug, please roll tape number three.
My name is Marcos. I was a Marine, and I was an infantryman while I was in. I served three tours in Iraq. The first deployment was during the invasion, and it was really just everything happened so fast, and just coming straight out of infantry school, being exposed to combat right off the bat was definitely a shock. But things were moving at such a fast pace, I really didn't have time to think about anything. I think after my third deployment, I lost two buddies of mine that were in my squad to a suicide bomber. It really made me question really the importance of life and how things can end really quickly. I had been talking to them 1 minute, and literally, you know, about 20 seconds later, they're gone. And I think a lot of what was on my mind was that, you know, we had plans when we got out. We were going to go to school together. We were going to, you know, maybe get an apartment together and just live life, you know, and in a shadow of instant, that's gone. You know, especially coming from an infantry background where you're out, you know, 24/7, patrols, whatever the case is, it was very difficult for me to comprehend that I could go outside of my house at, you know, 2, 3 in the morning without a weapon and be able to walk the streets and nothing was going on. I could hear a pin drop, and it was very unsettling. The peace was very unsettling. You know, just trying to get used to not having a schedule, not having someone to answer to, not having people under me that are looking for leadership or guidance or whatever the case. I think that was probably one of the biggest issues, just not having a direction. At the time, I really didn't know what PTSD was or any of these mental issues that, you know, are now very, you know, they're out in the media and very popularized. But I think everything relating to my PTSD was pointed out by somebody else, either a friend or a family member, only because the way I reacted to situations was very aggressive. In the military, especially in the infantry, when you're out on the street, you're taught to, you know, escalation of force, to escalate situations, you know, and that's how I would view my situation, my relationships while I was in the States as a civilian. So that's how I would go from 0 to 60, and my voice would be at what most would perceive a yell. So people would ask me, why are you getting so mad? And I'm like, I'm not mad. This is just how I talk. So I was completely oblivious to any of that. One of the things that I was dealing with, and still is an issue today, is being around groups of people. You know, which was obviously if you're going on a school campus, it's kind of hard not to be around groups of people. And I felt that I couldn't go anywhere with having my back exposed, you know, with people walking behind me that I didn't know. So I'd often, you know, turn around, check, as we say in the military, you know, checking my six, making sure that nothing shady was going on behind me. My self-medication was riding motorcycles. You know, it's pretty much a cliche, you know, Marine, fast motorcycle, whatever the case. So that's how I dealt with it. And, you know, I was dealing with it. I was going, you know, 120 down the street on public street, and you know, made a wrong move and went down pretty hard, probably at 80 miles an hour. And as I'm laying there on my back, I'm starting to realize, like, all these things that are going on. My aggressiveness toward others, you know, me yelling, me staying up at all hours of the night, you know, partying, just really dangerous behavior. I noticed that there might be something going on, but still at this point, I'm really ignorant to what it is. I just know that something's going on. I'm not like everybody else, and it's not just because I was in the military or whatever, but my experiences might have played a part in some way, shape, or form to how I'm acting now, which is becoming self-destructive. I was in school, and you know, I had a few situations there where there were a lot of ignorant students to what was going on out in the world, and the comment hadn't been made, Iraq and Afghanistan, I didn't even know that was going on anymore. And I just completely lost it and walked out of the class and, you know, didn't go back that semester. I'm 22 years old, you know, been through 3 combat deployments, seen friends go, had a lot of close calls myself, and now I'm here sitting in a classroom with people that don't really respect the teachers and are talking out of turn, and that kind of thing was just playing into my PTSD so much. It was making it hard to learn. So I hear about a vet center that's close to me, Gardena, California. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to go check it out. And while I'm there, I start talking to combat veterans and talking to other vets that I was working with, and start realizing that a lot of the symptoms that these people are dealing with, I'm dealing with as well. And I'm starting to learn a little bit more about what this PTSD thing is. And I started noticing that by working at the vet center, by being around these clinicians and speaking with other vets that have gotten help before, it was starting to help me. It really saved my life, because I really, at that point, you know, was probably at a really low time in my life, because, again, I didn't have that physical strength that I was used to in the Marines, and still dealing with this aggression that I didn't, this really unchecked aggression that I didn't really know where it was coming from. And dealing with the loss of my friends as well. So it was nice to be able to get in, speak with other combat veterans, and them reassuring me that, hey, you know what, there are others going through this as well. So it just, it was a really positive experience and encouraged me to continue to seek counseling. And after I started receiving counseling through the vet center, I was able to better recognize my triggers. Now, was I completely able to erase all the symptoms of PTSD? Absolutely not. But I didn't let them get to a 10. I was able to spot them at maybe a level 2 or 3. So I was able to understand, you know what, I better step aside, take a breather, walk away. Is this situation really worth it? Is it really worth arguing over, making a scene in you know, public setting? I don't have to escalate the situation as I did in the past. I can now accept it and move forward, knowing that it doesn't have any bearing on my life, and I can just continue on. When you're separating from the military, your mission is to transition as successfully and issue-free as possible. Your mission now is to take care of yourself, to perform that preventative maintenance, whether that be going to the VA medical center or going to the vet center, but just put the check in the box. You know, go get checked out. I lost 2 friends this year to suicides, and you know, it's probably the most heartbreaking thing, because you're right there, but your friends don't feel that they can reach out or they have somebody to reach out to. So it's important for not only veterans to reach out to other veterans, but if there is an issue, make it known. Confide in either another veteran that you know or come out and seek professional counseling. I know myself, it's helped me. It's helped a lot of my friends that have been going through the same exact issues to be able to get out and seek counseling, and speak to their friends. And if you're not comfortable speaking to a friend or family member, then come to the vet center or come to the VA.
I think that's great advice. And thank you, Marcos, for sharing his experience with other veterans. And this next tape, we're going to hear from a veteran who was injured while deployed. He went to the VA for health care. Like many veterans, he didn't want to admit to the other difficulties he was facing. However, he discovered the VA's approach to treating him as a whole person, including his post-traumatic stress, which helped him to go on to enjoy a healthier, more fulfilled life. So, Doug, if you'll please roll the 4th tape.
My name is Leif, Army Infantry. I was stationed in Camp Virginia in Kuwait. I was a gunner doing convoy security from Kuwait all up and down Iraq. During an IED blast, the car, you know, swerved and we hit a big pothole, and just the compression of all the weight just smashed my spine. So I ended up with 3 compression fractures, a full tear in my ligament, and then kind of concussion syndrome. When I got home, I wasn't kept on orders. When I got home, I was just told, you know, wait for your terminal leave, which would be 2 weeks for me, and then just go to the VA, they'll treat you. When I first joined up, my wife was supportive. But then when I got back and she knew I was going to deploy, things kind of got a little rough. And I believe she just didn't want to be alone. And then when I left, she was alone for, you know, a long time. And when I got home, I guess me being a little bit more angry, like just in that kind of enraged kind of, I just think arguments and things just didn't work out. And we ended up in a divorce. My first panic attack I had, I was actually still with my wife at the time, and we were walking in the shopping mall, and all of a sudden my neck just started like clenching, and I was like tripping, just going, whoa, what's going on? It was an overwhelming feeling that there was like a sniper pointing at me. I was crying, but you know, trying to hold it in, be tough. And then all of a sudden my training took over. I don't really remember much, but I guess I grabbed her and we went like maybe a foot against the wall and just went out this back, you know, back way of the mall. I was really explosive coming home, getting in a lot of fights, getting really depressed where, you know, I wanting to end it a few times. I was always scanning, and because I was always the front gunner up in the front of the convoy. So always scanning on the freeway, and I'm driving 80 miles an hour because I want to get through the kill zone. I don't ever want to be driving slow. And when my girlfriend drives, I mean, I'm constantly being the truck commander. Go, go, go. And I mean, she gets kind of annoyed sometimes, but luckily she's very patient. First 2 years, I drank every single day, morning to night. So I was self-medicating, trying to hide, you know, feelings and things like that. You know, I had the suicidal thoughts, and I just felt worthless, completely worthless. Like, you know, I'm not a good dad. Why, you know, my son's not living with me. Like, I'm not working. I'm, you know, just everything. And then, you know, the things I did over there. And so I decided to check into the psych ward at the VA. And that was a big help because I got to see a bunch of other guys and we were just all in the same boat. When I got into the VA, that's when my care really started taking place. And like a lot of guys were scared to, you know, go to the VA, or they just thought, you know, oh, I'm less of a man, or nothing's really wrong with me, I don't need to go. But me, I mean, I really did have the problems, but then when going through, you know, I learned the process, and it was real easy. You go to some warrior transition center, and they give you a caseworker, and then that caseworker books all your, you know, office visits. You don't really have to do much. You just call them, and they did everything for me. At first, I felt stupid, embarrassed. I didn't want to admit it to people that I was doing it. But once they start helping you and you're in the meetings and you have these, you know, Vietnam vets are helping everybody when you go in. And they give you tips and tricks and stuff on how to deal with it. But then they also tell you, you have to learn how to live with it.
Yeah, well, thanks, Leif, for sharing your experience. And Rick, in the interest of time, let's move into our fifth tape from another veteran who witnessed his friend's death while they were deployed and making a difficult adjustment back to the real world. Doug, if you'll roll the fifth tape.
My name's Todd. I worked, I was in the Army National Guard for 11 years. I started in 98, got out in 2009. I was deployed in Bosnia and Kosovo in 2003 to 2004. And then I was deployed to Iraq from 2005 to 2007. I was on a patrol with another Humvee. It was just us, the R. Bradley and a Humvee. And we rolled past a checkpoint. We were in an area where there was some suspicious activity going on. So we went to check it out, and we happened to cross a checkpoint after that was over, and the Humvee behind me hit I think it was a 200-pound IED that was in propane tanks buried pretty deep in the ground. And there was five people in that vehicle. Two ended up dying. One guy was a double amputee. The other two guys had a couple scratches and some concussions. But that was probably about the time where everything started for me as far as, like, changing my life and my way of thinking and what I did things. Then I got home, and it was weird because the sort of the excitement of just being home and not having to worry about, you know, each day whether you're going to still be around or not. So the actual excitement of being home, I think, overtook everything for about 8 months to almost a year. And then after that, you start trying to deal with the changes that have been there the whole time. You just didn't realize until then. It got to the point where my wife at the time and I, our values were different. We were never on the same page on anything. What was important to me before really wasn't that important to me anymore, and what was important to me wasn't really that important to her. She told me several times, she's like, you know, I kind of like the old you, and I said, well, that guy, he's long gone. The hardest thing is accepting that you're going to have to somehow adapt to that new guy. And a lot of times you don't want to, which is a lot of times you just resort to different things like anger. And yeah, it was pretty tough, bumpy road. I just felt different about her and about our life and about the thing. Like, I always knew I could still be a good dad, and I still am, but putting, you know, 110% into your kids and then putting 20% into your marriage, wow, that doesn't work out so well. So I guess I tried to just put it under, you know, not deal with it, just think to myself, it'll pass, you know. And but she'd continue to want to help in certain ways, and I didn't want it. And it got to the point where we basically just had nothing. It wasn't even a marriage. I was going through the divorce. We had separated out of the house. And, you know, kind of being there alone, just being by yourself and just realizing, you're like, it wasn't until just recently, like maybe back in February or March, that I wanted to go and get help and get some of the front. I mean, that's 4 years of being back and saying, it's no problem. Yeah, it'll go away. Never does. It never goes away. To better the future for your family and, like, your kids and a future relationship, you have to find it within yourself to say it's time. I went to the vet center and I talked to a therapist there. Talking about stuff at the vet center was really, really helpful. She found certain things that I need to, and just you lay it all out on the table, and one by one you just kind of sort of set it down. You just put it down, you ask, you really dig inside yourself and say, it's going to be tough, but in order for me to get better, I need to drop some of this weight that you carry around. The road's not easy, but I tell you, the end result, like, I can see it, you know what I mean? I can see myself in a much better position in life. Like, once you start doing all that stuff, it's like you've already dropped all that stress and all that anxiety about it. even the fact of just getting help, being anxious about just getting the help itself. As soon as you take that first step, it is a huge relief.
Well, thank you so much to our five veterans tonight. We'd like to now hear from two VA employees. One's going to talk about the suicide prevention program. Her name is Iris Roundtree, and she'll be talking with Dr. Stephen Sayers, who's the director of the Coaching into Care program. Doug, if you'll please roll our last tape.
Hi, I'm Iris Roundtree, Suicide Prevention Coordinator at the Corporal Michael J. Krishens VA Medical Center.
Hi, I'm Dr. Stephen Sayers. I'm the director of Coaching into Care based here at the Krishens VA Medical Center.
This year is Suicide Prevention Month, and our theme this year is Be There. Every year I get a little more excited. While we work every day to keep veterans safe, September is the month that we actually set aside for increased awareness of suicide prevention. Our theme again this year is Be There. We want veterans to know that we are going to be there for them. Today, I will be highlighting the Veterans Crisis Line. I speak of the Veterans Crisis Line with much of the same pride as a new parent. The Veterans Crisis Line was born in 2007, Canandaigua, New York. We opened with just a few staff and about 12 lines. Today, we've expanded to Atlanta, Georgia, and Topeka, Kansas, and we currently have over 144 lines. Here's the crescendo. Since 2007, we have responded to over 3.9 million calls. To reach the Veterans Crisis Line, you may call 1-800-273-8255. Again, that number is 1-800-273-8255. Veterans may reach us by calling, texting, or chatting. One of our very valuable resources is called Coaching into Care. Oftentimes, families call us because they have a family member with a need. Perhaps they have tried several things and they're facing crisis. We want families to be there for veterans as well. So today, Coaching into Care is going to be discussed on this call. Steve, what does Coaching into Care do?
Well, Coaching into Care is it's a national telephone-based service, and we take calls from family members who are concerned about a veteran. Perhaps they're concerned about veterans' mood, and their mood might have changed recently, or they're concerned about how much they drink, and they would like to help that veteran make the choice to get into mental health care. And that's really the purpose of Coaching into Care. We're there to talk to family members and friends who don't know what to say and don't know how to help and support a veteran in making that choice. Coaching into Care can be reached at 888-823-7458. That's 888-823-7458.
Is Coaching into Care another crisis line?
No, the best place for folks to call for a veteran in crisis would be the Veterans Crisis Line, of course. And that number, of course, is 800-273-8255. Coaching into Care provides help to family members who want to help a veteran who may have recently been in crisis but are currently safe. We actually help connect callers if we're working with a family member and they relay to us that the veteran is in crisis, and we'll help them reach the crisis line. Coaching into Care also gets referrals from the crisis line of family members who have called and they've determined that the veteran is currently safe, but the family member would like to talk to that veteran about the concerns that they have so they can make the choice to enter mental health care.
So what is coaching? Tell me a little bit about coaching.
Sure. Coaching is the strategy we use with family member callers. And basically, it's us coaching the family member to communicate more clearly, to be better listeners, to be basically a resource for the veteran as they consider their mental health treatment choices. A lot of veterans, and just like all of us, are really sometimes reluctant to make that decision to enter into mental health care. We're concerned about how it makes us look. We're concerned about it making us look weak and feel like we can just do it all our own. The family member is there to be a sounding board and to be ready to assist the veteran when they decide to make that choice to enter into mental health care. And that's really how we coach family members.
Oh, okay. Well, how long does coaching take?
Well, the first call from a concerned family member or friend is really about 10 to 30 minutes. Average is around 20 minutes. We gather a little bit of background information, what the concern is of the family member caller or friend, a bit about the veteran and what era they're from, and what the concern seems to be. We try to make sure that the current situation is a safe one. And at that point, is if there seems to be a crisis, we will actually connect the caller to the crisis line. But if not, we will take that information, provide some referrals and resources, and then talk with the family member about coaching. So that first call is about 20 minutes. Now, if the decision is to start working with that family member in a coaching strategy, there's really an unlimited number of calls that we'll provide the family member free. And those coaching calls are about 20 to 30 minutes. And it's really variable as to how many calls that we provide family members. It all depends on the needs of the family members and how long the coaching process takes to really help that family member be a good sounding board for the veteran.
So is there a fee for coaching into care?
No, it's absolutely free. It is a service provided by Department of Veterans Affairs. We're a national service, it's important to say. We're based here in Philadelphia. We have two other sites, but we work as one call center and one number to reach us. That's 888-823-7458. And our staff works as one to take that call anywhere from the United States. And we have a database of referrals, and it's certainly a directory for all the VA facilities all over the nation. So we can help callers from wherever they call us in the continental United States.
What are your hours?
Our hours are 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., Monday through Friday. That's Eastern time. We have the later hours to catch those callers who are calling from the West Coast. Now, if folks reach us late in the evening or on the weekends, they can certainly leave a message and we'll get back to them within one business day.
Okay. Well, I'm curious, what do I do if I'm a veteran and I'm going to be homeless or in crisis? How does that work?
Well, we have specific call centers for the prevention of homelessness in veterans and for benefits. Those are different call numbers, which I can give you. The Homeless Veterans Call Center is 877-424-3838. And the number for benefits is 800-827-1000. However, if a family member calls us or a veteran calls us at Coaching Into Care, we can just connect you with those services directly. So it's not a wrong number to call us. We can just simply connect you with those numbers.
Okay, but why can't your team just call and talk to the veteran directly? Why is it important that the caller or a family member be the one to call?
Well, typically family members are calling because a veteran has indicated they're reluctant or just absolutely refuse to talk about their mental health issues and going to care. And often it's because the family member has been fairly insistent, and then that ends up to be a little friction around that question. So if we were to call the veteran directly, that would really be seen as the veteran is really quite intrusive and not a wanted telephone call. So the first thing that we do in coaching a family member is to learn to step back a bit and do less telling and more listening.
Okay.
And so we're there to help that family member just really be a better support for the veteran and a better listener so that when the veteran's ready to talk about what it is that they're concerned about, that family member is ready to listen. So that's really why we work with family members rather than call the veteran directly.
Okay, that's good. But can you give me an example of a case and how Coaching Into Care works with families?
Sure. I was working with the wife of a veteran just recently, and she was really concerned about the veteran's alcohol consumption. And this had really been going on for a couple of years. I worked with that the wife of the veteran for a good number of months, and using a very positive and supportive approach, helped her navigate around the times when alcohol consumption was problematic. Uh-huh. But when the veteran was talked about how she could be a listener and let him know how much she appreciated his sobriety, and that she was there to talk about the concerns that he had. Now, this took many, many conversations, and as you might imagine, some really difficult times when alcohol use, you know, produced conflict between the two of them. But the part that the role that I played was to really support the wife of that veteran through those difficult times, so that she was there in sober times to talk about the veteran, what he was concerned about. And he finally did make the decision to reach out and talk to a counselor, went to a vet center in this case. So it took several months. This is not easy or quick work sometimes, particularly with a recurrent, long-lasting problem. But I talked with her about every couple of weeks for about 30 minutes. And so that's essentially what the work was like. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, a lot of times we run into resistance. What do you do when the veteran is just not interested in getting help?
Well, I think none of us can really make another human being do something that they don't want to do.
Okay.
But typically when veterans are struggling, or any of us are struggling with a mental health issue, we don't think one way or the other. We have ambivalence. So part of us really wants to get help, part of us resisting it. And what we're trying to help family members do is align themselves with the part of a person who's really considering taking another path in their life. And so helping the family member be patient and listen for those moments and have conversations in that circumstance is really the thing to do. Rarely, even folks who are adamant about not seeking care have moments when they consider that, you know, this path that I've taken so far is not the right one, and I want to consider having a more healthy lifestyle, perhaps not using alcohol, or perhaps learning to be less irritable, learning to be a happier person, and to address the concerns and traumas that they've experienced. So that's really the strategy.
Okay. I have one last question. As a suicide prevention coordinator, we're often asked by family members, can someone actually come to my house and talk to my son or daughter or spouse? How does that work?
Well, there's several ways that it could work. Sometimes if the family member believes that there's a current risk to the veteran's life, we will connect them with the crisis line, and they may dispatch a local emergency personnel. So that's really the most crisis kinds of situations. In other situations, it may just be a well check call from the crisis line. And we won't do that from coaching and care. We'll ask the crisis line personnel to do that, because they have access to records, and it's really something separate than our work with the family member. But that's sometimes a very important step, just to make sure that veteran is safe. Another way that it might work is that we are able to, in coaching and care, help family members be aware of the mental health crisis teams in their community. So if it comes to pass that they're concerned that the veteran has done something or is behaving in a way that maybe is self-injurious, they can call the mental health crisis team rather than 911 in their community, and have trained personnel to come out and talk with the veteran about what's going on. So there's a lot of different scenarios, but those are three.
Well, thank you so much. In closing, Stephen, I would like to share with you our numbers one more time. To reach the Veterans Crisis Line, you would call 1-800-273-8255.
And to reach Coaching into Care, family members or friends want to call because they're concerned about a veteran not in mental health care, call 888-823-7458.
Thank you. We're going to be there for you.
Well, that was great to hear them, Rick. We only got about a minute left. I just want to add one thing
about that that they kind of left out. The program's open from on Friday, Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, that's Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. And again, that number is 1-888-823-7458 for coaching in the care and the Veterans Crisis
Line. And that's Eastern time. The 8 to 8 is
correct.
Eastern time.
And the Veterans Crisis Line is 1-800-273-8255, and then press 1. David, close us out.
Yeah, thanks. Well, it's been a quick hour. I'd like to thank all of you for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli and Corey and Hurley Law Group, and our show producer here at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. Hope you'll tune in next week. Our special guest will be Lauren Price, director of the Veterans Warriors, a veteran advocacy group. We'll be here next Monday, same time, same station. We hope you'll tune in. Until then, hope you have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week, when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.